Chapter 21, The Roots of Anti-Semitism 2, Crime and Treachery. I grew up on movies. I never failed to go to the Saturday matinee, and over the years, movies have been my main form of entertainment. My idea of an evening out is still dinner and a movie. Of the hundreds of films I've seen over the years, I have many recollections of gangster films. Because of those films and many newspaper and magazine articles and novels, I long associated organized crime with Italians, specifically with Sicilian Americans. It is a common association. Gangsters are synonymous in almost everyone's mind with Italian features and Italian accents. One makes an almost automatic subliminal connection between the gangsters and spaghetti. In high school, I came across an article about Murder Incorporated, a huge criminal syndicate based in New York City that was one of the most evil and powerful crime organizations in the history of the United States. It specialized in murder for hire and ran every kind of criminal racket, generating hundreds of deaths and the theft of tens of millions of dollars. Thomas Dewey, later a presidential candidate, helped break up the organization. The cast of characters of Murder Incorporated amazed me, for they were almost all Jews. Its original members became the leaders of organized crime throughout the 1980s and included crime boss Meyer Lansky. I then read that the biggest boss of organized crime since the time of Al Capone was in fact Jewish. I thought he'd be Sicilian as depicted in the movies. The book Lansky by Hank Messick documented a view of organized crime far different than I saw at my Saturday matinees. The top law enforcement sources and investigative reporters agree that Lansky was the master gangster in America for most of the 20th century. He had been the most powerful person in the American crime syndicates for four decades, yet most Americans, who certainly know the names of Al Capone and John Dillinger, have never heard of Meyer Lansky. The most notorious gangster was not Italian. He was, in fact, Jewish and an ardent supporter of Zionism. Here's a quotation from Newsweek magazine. Each year, Lansky and his underworld associates pour vast sums into Israeli bonds and Israeli philanthropies. As the Daily Haaretz saw it, the government seemed afraid of losing the millions of dollars in illicit money first laundered in mob-controlled institutions and then funneled into Israeli business and industry. Investigative reporter Jack Anderson talked about the issue in the Washington Post. The underworld boodle, much of it raised from nefarious enterprises in the United States, is laundered before it arrives in Israel. In Lansky, Messick reveals the relationship between Israeli and American Jewish gangsters. Quote, certainly Jewish gangsters have long and openly supported Jewish causes and the State of Israel. On the night Lansky's ex-partner, Bugsy Siegel, was executed, the Flamingo is taken over by Mo Sedgway. When asked how he so conveniently happened to be in Las Vegas, he explained he was there to arrange United Jewish Appeal Fund Drive. As an illustration of how Jewish gangsters are treated in Hollywood media, one only has to look at the treatment according to the notorious gangster Bugsy Siegel in the film Bugsy. The film downplayed his Jewishness and portrayed one of America's most bloodthirsty and merciless murderers as a handsome and playful romantic, a man of vision. And he was portrayed by the thoroughly Anglo-Saxon-looking Warren Beatty. Siegel was portrayed as a kind-hearted man who had a somewhat rough side. And even though I was familiar with the horrible deeds of the real Bugsy Siegel, while watching the movie, I found myself liking him. It did not surprise me to learn that the film had been written by James Toback and directed by Barry Levinson. Messick sums it up very well when he writes, and I quote, the real leaders of crime have remained hidden while the nation's law enforcement agencies have chased minor punks. Research reveals that non-mafia leaders of crime have been hiding behind the vendetta-ridden society for decades. I have been smeared as an anti-Semite from coast to coast by gangsters who use religion as a cloak. The next section is Russian Revolution and or Russian Mafia. And by the way, for documentation, go to my hardback copy of Jewish Supremacism or the online copy you can buy through davidduke.com, and you can check out every quotation that I give here and every documentation that I offer in this book. This section is called Russian Revolution and or Russian Mafia. In the final years of the 20th century, the most dangerous criminal organization in the United States and all over the world is the Russian Mafia. Much like the truth about the so-called Russian Revolution, the Russian Mafia is neither Russian nor Mafia. In a word, it's Jewish. Just as the media downplayed the huge role of Jewish organized crime in America throughout the 20th century, from Murder Incorporated to Meyer Lansky's Syndicate, so they have hidden from the American people the truth about the modern crime syndicate called the Organizatsiya, the most powerful criminal organization in the world. The members of the Organizatsiya come from the parts of the former Soviet Empire, but they don't identify themselves as Russian, and certainly not as Italian mafia. They are exceedingly proud Jews who support Jewish causes with the same exuberance shown by Meyer Lansky and his cohorts. In the mid-1970s, I read Hustling on Gorky Street, a book written by Yuri Brokhin, a former Jewish pimp from one of the crime organizations in Russia. Konstantin Simas, a prominent Jewish lawyer for organized crime, wrote another important book on the subject called USSR, The Corrupt Society. Now, both books make clear the Jewish control of organized crime in the Soviet Union. Brokhin brags that Jews are the only ones intelligent enough to run large-scale organized crime. Slavs, he says, are capable only of street crime. Of course, neither book mentions the advantages of Jewish criminals having allies in the heavily Jewish Soviet bureaucracy. When the communist regime fell, the already powerful Jewish crime groups grew dramatically, so much so that it could be said that no nation has ever suffered more in the grip of organized crime than Russia does today. Even the former Russian president, Boris Yeltsin, was clearly under the thumb of organized crime, as evidenced by his appointment of Jewish organized crime boss figure, Boris Berezovsky, to Russia's National Security Council. Yeltsin had to rescind Berezovsky's appointment after some of Russia's non-Jewish newspapers made an issue of his crime connections. Berezovsky is thought to be the richest person in Russia, followed closely by his fellow tribesman Vladimir Grzinski, who has become the most powerful media boss. Since the fall of the Soviet Union, the Jewish mob spread rapidly all over the world, and many authorities and law enforcement now considered its American branch as the most powerful and dangerous crime organization in America. After the murder of comedian Bill Cosby's son in Los Angeles, the press identified the alleged murderer as Mikhail Markasev, a Ukrainian immigrant, when in fact he was a Jewish member of the so-called Russian Mafia. Invariably, Jewish film and television producers portray the gangsters as blonde, blue-eyed Russians with not even a scant suggestion of their real Jewish identity. Casting these Jewish criminals as Russians is a double lie. It is inaccurate as to their Jewish origin, and it's a libel against the Russian people. Again, the contradictions of Jewish power come to the fore. The masters of the media will not tolerate a truthful expose of Jewish perfidy, yet they perpetrate false and pernicious images of others. Occasionally, though, the truth breaks out, even if it's not in the movies. The Village Voice on May 26, 1998, ran a story called, quote, "The Most Dangerous Mobster in the World" by Robert Friedman, by the way, another fellow Jew, who has had the courage and temerity to write about the Jewish control of organized crime. Here's the quotation. According to the FBI and Israeli intelligence, Simon Moglevich rules over an arms trafficking, money laundering, drug running, and art smuggling Red Mafia, the most dangerous mobster in the world. The leader of the Red Mafia is a 52-year-old Ukrainian-born Jew. He is a shadowy figure known as the Brainy Don. He holds an economics degree, and he's never been exposed by the media. Unquote. Robert Friedman, himself Jewish, writes that the Organizatsiya has even brought in ex-commandos from Israel as gunmen, and they are so ruthless that some policemen will not work the cases because they so often go after a cop's family. Friedman goes on to write, and I quote, Jewish organizations have lobbied the Justice Department to downplay the Russian mob, fearing that adverse publicity will jeopardize the mass exodus of Russian Jews to Israel, unquote. Well, it might. But what about the exodus of Russian mafia Jews to America? Obviously, there's no concern about that. For the interest of the Israeli state to augment its Jewish population and the sacred interests of Jewish public relations are far more important than the rights of the people of the United States to defend themselves from this horrific Jewish organized crime syndicate. The Jewish 2% of the population has the dubious distinction of producing the lion's share of organized crime in America in the 20th century, from Murder Incorporated to Lansky Syndicate to the Russian Mafia of Semyon Moglevich. The hidden fact suggests the possibility of similar behavior in former times. Now, in looking into the history of Jewish criminal behavior, I found many historical figures and chroniclers who feared Jewish criminal organizations. Now, if this volume could afford the space, the below sampling could expand 100-fold. Let me quote from a few. Roman statesman Marcus Cicero. Flaccus, a friend who was a customs official, found himself persecuted for stopping the illegal flow of gold from Rome to Jerusalem. Cicero, in defending Flaccus, condemns such early smuggling and money laundering and the efforts to intimidate an honest public official from doing his duty. He says, "Softly, softly, I want none but the judges to hear me. The Jews have already got me into a fine mess, as they have many other gentlemen." Here's first century Roman philosopher Lucius Seneca. He referred to the Jews as, quote, "that most criminal nation." Napoleon. He said, "The Jews are the master robbers of the modern age. They are the carrion birds of humanity. We ought to ban the Jews from commerce because they abuse it." Unquote. Daniel Defoe. The works Roxana, Robinson Crusoe, and the military memoirs of Captain George Carleton have frequent allusions to greedy and unprincipled criminal Jews whose stock in trade is fenced stolen articles. William Prime, Puritan writer opposing Cromwell's effort to allow the Jews back in England, describes Jewish offenses as usuries and deceits, clippings, and falsifying monies, and that's from a short demurrer to the Jews' long-discontinued remitter into England. Charles Dickens, one of the icons of English literature, had the classic characterization of the criminal Jew, Fagin, in Oliver Twist. The character would enlist Gentile children to pickpocketry an assortment of similar criminal enterprises. And of course, the Roman historian Tacitus, who said, "Among themselves, they are inflexibly honest and ever ready to show compassion, though they regard the rest of mankind with all the hatred of enemies." And boy, when I read that, I think about what's happening in Lebanon right now. There is much evidence of a Jewish-dominated criminal underworld that has existed for hundreds of years. One of the most amazing things I discovered was a book published at the time of Protestant reformer Martin Luther. Europe was so plagued by organized crime that the authorities felt compelled to publish a lexicon of criminal terms. Luther supported its publication as a means of fighting crime and wrote an introduction to the lexicon in which he noted that the vocabulary of criminals was full of Hebrew words. In the preface, Luther wrote, quote, "I consider it useful that this book be widely read, so that it may be seen and understood how the devil rules this world, so that men may be wise against him. It is true that the Rothwelsche Sprache, underworld slang, comes from the Jews, for it contains many Hebrew words, as those who know Hebrew well observe." Next section, when criminals control the media. The fact that so few Gentiles are aware of the long and integral relationship between Jews and organized crime is due to their enormous power in media that shields them from the image that Italians have in relation to the mafia. It is perhaps typified in the interconnectivity of Jewish organized crime in Russia and Jewish media power there. For instance, two of the leading organized crime figures there are Berezovsky and Vladimir Kuczynski. Both are media moguls in Russia, having enormous power in TV, radio, newspapers, and magazines. Kuczynski was recently indicted by the Russian prosecutor's office for corruption and money laundering. In 1999, Berezovsky seized control of Moscow's TV6 television station. Russia's premier daily newspaper, The Kommersant, was also acquired by Berezovsky, and he promptly fired its editor, Raf Shakirov, who said that, quote, "his ouster is an attempt to curb often critical coverage of the tycoon's business and political activities." Forbes magazine published a scathing article about Berezovsky entitled, quote, "The Godfather of the Kremlin," with no byline because of fear of violence against its authors. The magazine's editor, James Michaels, said that Berezovsky, quote, "stands tall as one of the most powerful men in Russia. Behind him lies a trail of corpses, uncollected debts, and competitors terrified for their lives." The Forbes article asserted, and I quote, "Assassination is a tool of business competition. Scores of business leaders and media personalities have been killed. Berezovsky controls Russia's biggest TV network. His control was solidified shortly after the first chairman of the network was assassinated gangland style. Berezovsky was immediately fingered by the police as a key suspect, but the murder remains unsolved 2 years later. Such is the Russian business environment today that the men at the top have use for the shadowy army of killers and thugs who work further down in the scale of corruption, running prostitute and protection rackets." Incredibly, in 1996, Berezovsky became a member of the Kremlin Security Council and privy to the most sensitive information of Russia. It was also revealed by the Moscow Times newspaper that Putin used to take his holidays at Berezovsky's summer home in Moscow. Yet, even for Putin, Berezovsky's blatant murder and racketeering was too much. The Russian prosecutor is now pursuing him for criminal indictment. Both Berezovsky and Kuczynski, now on the run from authorities, are screaming that they're simply victims of, quote, anti-Semitism. The relationship between Jewish organized power, organized crime, media, and government power is crystal clear in the former Soviet Union. Just as they seized power in 1917 as Bolsheviks, they have now seized power at the fall of communism through corruption and organized crime. Fortune magazine ran an article entitled "Russia's Robber Barons," profiling 10 of the most important Russian business tycoons and mobsters who've catapulted to economic dominance in Russia with the collapse of communism. These included Kuczynski, Berezovsky, Boris Haidt, Mikhail Friedman, Vladimir Vinogradov, Vladimir Potanin, Mikhail Khodorkovsky, Alexander Smolensky, and Pyotr Avin. It's estimated that more than 50% of Russia's raw wealth is owned by these 10 men. And of course, since the time of the writing of this book, many of these individuals have been prosecuted by the Russian government, including very actively by Vladimir Putin. Now, while the average Russian barely survives on less than an average of $200 per month, enormous wealth and power has been concentrated in the hands of a tiny group of men loyal not to the Russian people, but only to their tribe. These men certainly did not earn the vast wealth that they accumulated in only 3 or 4 years after the demise of communism. It was acquired through fraud, corruption, bribery, theft, and murder. The world knows almost nothing about the Jewish character of this theft of practically an entire nation, because the Jewish media in Russia and in the rest of the world has chosen to keep this vital fact from our consciousness. 9 out of the 10 leading robber barons of Russia listed by Fortune magazine are in fact Jews. With the demise of Mikhail Khodorkovsky, we now have a huge case of fraud going back between Russia and Israel, where most of the stolen money from this corporation has ended up in Israel. The next section is the slave trade. And I begin this section with a quotation from Leviticus, right from the Old Testament. This is Leviticus 25, 44, and 46. And listen to this quotation very carefully. As for your male and female slaves whom you may have, you may buy male and female slaves from among the nations that are round about you. 46. You may bequeath them to your sons after you to inherit as a possession forever. You may make slaves of them, but over your own brethren, the people of Israel, you shall not rule one over another with harshness. So here's a quotation from the Old Testament very clearly, that you're allowed to enslave non-Jews and keep them as your inheritance forever, forever. And at the same time, you're not allowed to enslave your fellow Jews. Although the institution of slavery existed throughout most of human history, trade in human flesh has never been looked upon as a noble occupation. Compassionate men and women have long decried cruel mistreatment of slaves, especially of women and children, by slaveholders and traders. Many agreed with Christ's admonitions to slaveholders to treat their slaves kindly. In contrast to the benevolent image assigned to them by the media, Jews historically dominated an international institution that embodied the darkest evils of human exploitation, the slave trade. My introduction into the important Jewish role in slave trading came from an article about Jews written by a leading Jewish historian and apologist, Jacob Marcus. The article was written in the Encyclopedia Britannica. Marcus casually remarked about the Jewish control of commerce in the Middle Ages, particularly the slave trade. Quote, "In the Dark Ages, the commerce of Western Europe was largely in the Jews' hand, in particular, the slave trade." Unquote. The Jewish mastery of the slave trade did not go unnoticed to Christian writers in the Middle Ages. I read poignant accounts of European children who suffered sexual and other abuses from Jewish slave traders who acquired them. In Roman times, they often followed the path of the conquering Roman army and enslaved enemy soldiers and civilians. Chroniclers of the ancient and medieval periods wrote of their preference for fair women and children, and of their frequent sale in the Levant. The Jewish slavers were more than happy to satisfy darker men's taste for white flesh. Horrified by reports of abuse of Christian women and children by Jews, a number of Christian principalities issued edicts detailing these abuses, and forbidding Jews to own or trade in Christian women and children. Jews, in writing their own histories, have matter-of-factly acknowledged the Jewish role in slave trading, looking at it as simply an extremely lucrative Jewish commercial venture. In A History of the Jew, From Babylonian Exile to the End of World War II, published by the Jewish Publication Society of America, The author writes very emphatically, quote, Jews were among the most important slave dealers in European society. It really surprised me when I found out that Jews played a prominent role in American slavery. In the early 1970s, I came across a book called Who Brought the Slaves to America by Walter White. I could understand the role of Jews in the slave trade of the Mediterranean region, but it seemed unlikely to me that the very small Jewish population in the early American colonies could dominate such a large enterprise. I also retained, at that time, Hollywood's image of white men, perhaps even Southerners, sailing to Africa and rounding up black natives for the slave trade. In movies, articles, and books, slavers were Anglo-Saxons with names like Smith or Jones. Usually they were hard-drinking, uncouth Southern types. Later I learned that slavery was ubiquitous in Africa among native blacks themselves, and that they were seldom rounded up by whites. Usually, black African slaveholders were the ones who sold them to the slaveholders who brought them to the Americas. Who Brought the Slaves to America steered me to the library collections that house the records of slave ships, contemporary accounts, and a number of Jewish historians who documented the role Jews have played in slavery. The Jewish writers I read were prideful in their accounts of the great Jewish slave traders. A good example in point is Mark Raphael's Jews and Judaism in the United States, a documentary history. And I quote, Jewish merchants played a major role in the slave trade. In fact, in all the American colonies, whether French, Martinique, British, or Dutch, Jewish merchants frequently dominated. This was no less true on the North American mainland, where during the 18th century, Jews participated in the triangular trade that brought slaves from Africa to the West Indies and there exchanged them for molasses, which in turn was taken to New England and converted into rum for sale in Africa. Isaac da Costa of Charleston in the 1750s, David Franks of Philadelphia in the 1760s, and Aaron Lopez of Newport in the late 1760s and early 1770s dominated Jewish slave trading on the American continent. In North America, the slave trade had its most powerful center in Newport, Rhode Island. Now, Newport formed a pivotal part of the triangular slave trade of rum and molasses from New England to Africa for slaves and back to the West Indies and the colonies with the human cargo. I discovered it was no coincidence that Newport, the center of the slave trade, had the oldest synagogue in America and the largest thriving Jewish community in the entire American colonies. Aaron Lopez, a Portuguese Jew of Morano descent and a resident of Newport, was one of the most powerful slave traders in the Americas. He owned dozens of ships and imported thousands of blacks into the Western Hemisphere. In an account of just two voyages of one of Lopez's ships, the Cleopatra, at least 250 blacks perished. Now, such horrendous loss of life in such a dirty business did not prevent Jewish chronicler Jacob Marcus from praising Lopez, quote, what can be said about this most attractive figure, unquote. Although Lopez acquired riches in the colonies, he violated the anti-British non-importation trade agreements during the Revolutionary period, supporting British interests rather than the colonies. Now, Jews dominated the slave trade not only in the American colonies, but all over the New World. In a major Jewish history of the early Americas called, quote, New World Jewry, 1492 to 1776, one can find the following passage. They came with ships carrying African blacks to be sold as slaves. The traffic in slaves was a royal monopoly, and the Jews were often appointed as agents for the crown in their sale. They were the largest ship chandlers in the entire Caribbean region, where the shipping business was mainly a Jewish enterprise. The ships were not only owned by Jews, but were manned by Jewish crews and sailed under the command of Jewish captains. Unquote. Many Jewish writers chronicle the Jewish role in slavery, often boasting of the shrewdness in that business. The West India Company, which monopolized imports of slaves from Africa, sold slaves at public auctions against cash payment. It happened that cash was mostly in the hands of Jews. The buyers who appeared at the auctions were almost always Jews, and because of this lack of competitors, they could buy slaves at low prices. On the other hand, there was also no competition in the selling of the slaves to the plantation owners and other buyers, and most of them purchased on credit payable at the next harvest in sugar. Profits of up to 300% of purchase value were often realized with high interest rates. If it happened that the date of such an auction fell on a Jewish holiday, the auction had to be postponed, and this occurred on Friday, October 21, 1644. Unquote. Although certainly indefensible by today's moral standards, slavery in the United States was many times preferable to the incredibly cruel and murderous conditions of African slavery. The greatest inhumanity of black slavery is associated with the passage to America. Some say that 10 to 15% of black slaves died in the cramped and filthy conditions on the ships. Since the Jews have dominated the slave trade from ancient times, I realized that it's not only blacks who have suffered from the inhuman conditions, but also untold numbers of white people of the Mediterranean region. It should also be pointed out that not only were Jews the principal slave traders, they had a markedly higher per capita holding of slaves than non-Jews. Quote, all through the 18th century into the early 19th, Jews in the North were to own black servants. In the South, the few plantations owned by Jews were tilled with slave labor. In 1820, over 75% of all Jewish families in Charleston, Richmond, and Savannah owned slaves employed as domestic servants. Almost 40% of all Jewish householders in the United States owned one slave or more. There were no protests against slavery as such by Jews in the South, where they were always outnumbered at least 100 to 1. Very few Jews anywhere in the United States protested against chattel slavery on moral grounds. Again, this is from Jewish sources. Now, considering that less than 10% of all colonists owned slaves, Marcus reveals that individual Jewish households, 40% owned slaves, were far more likely to own slaves than were Gentiles. With their comparatively greater numbers in the Mediterranean world, Jews constituted disproportionate slaveholders in the ancient and medieval world, just as they were in the colonies. The importation of slaves to America is a relatively recent historical phenomenon that lasted about 200 years. From before the time of Christ to the African trade of the 1700s, most of the slaves owned and bartered by Jews were white. When I learned of the Jewish role in the slave trade, it seemed to me that it could have certainly added to the resentment against the Jews felt by their host populations. Being known as the greatest perpetrators of the slave trade is not the best of public relations for Jews. It is no wonder that the Jewish-dominated media have avoided the issue. Only Jewish scholars who faithfully record Jewish history, primarily for Jewish readers, are allowed to travel on such forbidden historical ground. And by the way, I have a picture in the book of the cover of Newsweek, The Long Shadow of Slavery, and it has an article headlined, Spielberg's Controversial New Movie. And my caption is, Steven Spielberg's movie about the slave trade in Newport, Rhode Island, where it's centered, makes no mention of the predominant Jewish role in the slave trade. Now, after my first efforts on national television in the early 1970s to expose the Jewish role in slave trading, on PBS, Black Perspectives in the News, the Nation of Islam also did extensive research on the issue. Their historical research department came up with a tremendous amount of documented material on the subject that they published in the book called The Secret Relationship Between Blacks and Jews. Today, simply by repeating the words of prominent Jewish historians on the Jewish role in slavery, one becomes guilty of, quote, anti-Semitism, unquote. It was only when the public began to learn some of the little-known facts previously reserved for Jewish scholars that the ADL found it necessary to counter such anti-Semitic propaganda. The ADL and other Jewish organizations have responded by trotting out a number of prestigious Jewish scholars who have publicly announced that the Jewish role in the colonial slave trade was minimal. In Spielberg's blockbuster movie on the slave trade, Amistad, there was hardly a Jew to be found in the film, although the Jews dominated the Newport, Rhode Island slave trade. All the slavers in the film seemed conspicuously Christian. A number of articles that discussed Amistad and slave trading, including Time and Newsweek, went out of their way to deny a major Jewish role in the slave trading. Unfortunately, most of their readers were not told what prominent Jewish historians themselves wrote about the matter before it became an embarrassing public issue. Few will read the words of the editor of the magazine of the American Jewish Historical Society: Jewish merchants played a major role in the slave trade. In fact, in all the American colonies, whether French, Martinique, British, or Dutch, Jewish merchants frequently dominated. This is no less true on the North American mainland. Unquote. The next section is called White Slavery. Prostitution, or white slavery, as it's aptly called, is another institution as old as civilization. Even in ancient times, the fair skin and beauty of European women and little boys and girls brought a premium from the purveyors of perhaps the most brutal kind of slavery of all, the sexual defilement of one's body. The subjection of countless innocents to the filth and pain of sexual degradation is a crime of enormous magnitude. Just as they dominated the organized slave trade, Jews dominated prostitution. It originally came about as a natural adjunct to slavery, as it took no special commercial acumen to realize that a female or young boy slave could be rented out for sexual abuse, and fair European maidens could fetch great prices from the sultans of the darker nations. From the days of the concubines of King David to the modern madams, Xavier Hollander and Heidi Fleiss, Jews have dominated the sex business. The Talmud itself is obsessed with sexual connections and what it calls natural and unnatural kinds of sexual connections, of sexual relations with adults, with little boys and girls, with bondmaidens and with harlots. In the modern age, Freud and his colleagues in academia brought this perverted view of our natures into the classrooms and living rooms of America. Freud, with the help of his Jewish influence media, told Western society with a straight face that sexual and excretory organs are the most important factors in life, and that every male secretly desires to have sexual relations with his mother. In looking into the history of prostitution, I read about a maleficent deception Jews used in Central Europe during the last century. During times of famine or economic hardship, well-dressed, fast-talking Jews would go into peasant communities and tell the parents of attractive Christian teenagers that their children could have a better life in America, an America which had a shortage of household labor. The Jews told the parents that after a short time, their children could pay off the cost of their passage and begin a new life in the land of freedom and plenty. In spite of the pain of being separated from their children, some of the parents would consent to such an arrangement, wanting the best for their daughters. But instead of finding a bright new life, tens of thousands ended up suffering in the brothels of the New World. In his book Prostitution and Prejudice, Jewish historian Edward Bristow writes about the World Prostitution Network and clearly shows the prominent Jewish role. It's not hard to conceive of the reaction of many Eastern Europeans to the Jewish enslavement and degradation of tens of thousands of Christian girls. Bristow reveals that the center of the Jewish trade in Gentile women from Poland and surrounding regions was a small town called Auschwitz, which the Germans called Auschwitz. That simple revelation can bring much understanding of the recurrent Jewish and Gentile conflict. Jewish domination of white slavery continues. In fact, it is on a larger scale now than ever before in history. The New Orleans Times-Picayune on January 11, 1998, ran an article titled, quote, Slave Traders Lure Slavic Women. It, written by Michael Spector and distributed by the Jewish-run New York Times News Service, documents a Jewish-run white slave operation of huge proportions. The piece begins with a poignant story of how a beautiful blonde Ukrainian girl, hoping to escape poverty and despair of her village life, answered an ad in a small newspaper in her hometown promising work and opportunity abroad. She wound up as a sex slave in Israel. And here's a quotation. She was 21, self-assured, and glad to be out of Ukraine. Israel offered a new world, and for a week or two, everything seemed possible. Then one morning, she was driven to a brothel where her boss burned her passport before her eyes. I own you, she recalled his saying. You are my property, and you will work until you earn your way out. Don't try to leave. You have no papers, and you don't speak Hebrew. You'll be arrested and deported. Then we will get you and bring you back. Unquote. In Israel, the government does little to end the brutal slave system other than deport a small percentage of the girls they find with no immigration papers. Almost 1,500 Ukrainian women have been deported from Israel in the past 3 years. The deck is completely stacked against the Gentile women and in favor of the slave masters. For if they file a complaint against the slave master, they must remain in prison until a trial is held. Spector quotes the prison director at Nev-Tirsta as saying she did not know of a single girl who chose to testify against her Jewish slave masters. The white slaver is thus protected by the Israeli system while the victims are punished. Spector identifies both the prostitutes and their masters. He quotes an Israeli white slave master, Jacob Golan, and I quote, the women who work there, like nearly all prostitutes in Israel, are Russian. Their boss is not. Israelis love Russian girls, said Jacob Golan. They are blonde and good-looking and different from us, he said, chuckling. Unquote. Of course, Israel is not the only destination of the Eastern European women. The Jewish gangs in Russia have strong connections with Jewish organized crime syndicates all over the world. According to the Ukraine's Interior Ministry, an estimated 400,000 women under the age of 30 were lured from the Ukraine in the past decade. And this is just one of the former Soviet states. Spector quotes the International Organization for Migration as estimating that 500,000 Eastern Bloc women are trafficked into Western Europe and around the world annually. It's a tragedy of huge proportions that gets very little press. Moment Magazine, the magazine of Jewish culture and opinion, had an article on page 44 of the April 1998 edition called Hookers in the Holy Land. In it, they discuss the thriving prostitution of blonde Russian girls as a, quote, national institution. It goes on to talk about the customers who even include rabbis riding bicycles to the whorehouses. Quote, a good percentage of the customers, or Johns in the lingo, are ultra-Orthodox Jews, pious men whose lives are guided by halakha, religious law, which tells them when they can or cannot have sex with their wives. So on Thursday afternoons, boys' night out in Israel, busloads of Orthodox Jews travel from Jerusalem, Haifa, and points beyond to Tel Aviv for a few precious moments of passion in a massage parlor, behind a sand dune, or in an alleyway. Other customers are accountants, lawyers, policemen, and politicians. The entire spectrum of Israeli society is keeping the hookers in business, claims Detective Shakar, a cynical veteran on the Tel Aviv Vice detail. Tel Baruch is so very absurd and so very Israel. It blatantly goes on to describe the girls, who are mostly Eastern European Gentile women, along with some Palestinians, as virtual slaves who were put on a slave auction block. Quote, Once the girls arrive in Israel, the crime bosses take over. The girls are usually taken to an auction house where the owners of the various massage parlors can bid on the talent. Each one offers a price, and the highest bidder gets the girl. The girls are virtual slaves. Unquote. The article goes on to note that many of the prostitutes in Israel, especially those of Arab descent, encounter physical abuse from Jews who abuse them as an expression of their racial nationalist fervor. Unquote. Quote, find that their Jewish customers only come to them after a Palestinian terrorist act to get their own brand of sexual revenge laced with racial nationalistic fervor. And they do it with hate and anger. Unquote. In discussing the forged documents used to smuggle girls into Israel, Spector notes that they have often been obtained from elderly Jewish women in the Ukraine. Even so, Spector casually refers to the Jewish perpetrators of this international white slavery ring as, quote, Russian crime gangs or, quote, Russian mafia. It would be bad for Jewish public relations if the Times-Picayune had titled the article, Jewish Slave Traders Lure Gentile Women. Jewish writers in anti-Semitism never mention that Jewish domination of the slave trade or prostitution existed over centuries. They never point out that such Jewish activities could understandably lead to unfavorable attitudes toward Jews. Imagine the worldwide media reaction if Gentiles were enslaving hundreds of thousands of Jewish girls, putting them on auction blocks, subjecting them to indescribable brutalities. Consider the outrage that would bellow from the Jewish media. Yet with millions of Christian girls becoming victims of Jewish criminals, there is no moral outcry, no international cause trumpeted by celebrities and politicians. After my discussion of these issues on the national PBS program Black Perspectives in the News, attacks on me as a, quote, anti-Semite became even more shrill. As a young man, when I read about slavery in the South, my heart was touched by the tales of cruelty and suffering, so much so that I felt guilty. But as I learned the truth about the slave trade, I noticed that the same Jewish writers and producers and publishers who instill guilt in me about slavery and the slave trade never once suggested that Jews had any collective guilt for 2,000 years of plying their trade in human flesh. Apparently, in the new morality of the Jewish press, learning about white exploitation of blacks is history, but learning about Jewish exploitation of both whites and blacks is called, quote, hate, unquote. The next section is called disloyalty. Historically, the most common term other than moneylender associated with Jews has been tax collector. There have been many examples all the way through the 20th century of Jews being the main instruments of tax collection that ruling bodies used to raise revenue. The Jewish historian, Josephus, in his Antiquities of the Jews, tells the story of a Jewish tax collector named Joseph in the court of the Ptolemies, who was so ruthless and effective in collections that he bid twice the amount of anyone else for the right to collect taxes. In those times, kings often took bids from tax collectors, and the one who promised the highest set amount would obtain the commission, and he would keep for himself all he collected over the amount he promised to the king. Joseph's success came in no small part from the fact that he would kill and confiscate the property of those who refused to pay what he demanded. Joseph has described his success as, quote, stripping Syria to the bone, unquote. Yet he showed no restraint in his praise. Quote, Joseph was a good man and of great magnanimity and brought the Jews out of a state of poverty and meanness to one that was more splendid. That's, again, the quote from the Jewish historian Josephus. Rulers of multicultural empires often used Jews as administrators because the ruling powers knew that they would have no loyalty to the non-Jewish people of the lands where they resided. Jews made excellent tax collectors. They had good financial acumen, and they had the required trait of all good tax collectors, little sympathy for the taxpayer. In the Muslim world, the practice of using Jews as occupying administrators can be seen in the Arab conquest and rule over Spain in the 8th to 11th centuries. In the Fatimid rule over Tunisia in the 10th century, the Marinid occupation of Morocco in the 13th to 15th centuries, during Mongol rule in Iraq, and in the 16th century Ottoman period, the practice was continued even into the 20th century in Morocco, where the French used them in this role over Muslims. In the post-World War II satellite states, the Soviet Union, in Eastern Europe, and even at one time in the control exercised by King Faisal in Iraq. One of the most repeated charges that anti-Semites have made is that in retaining loyalty to their own perceived group interest, Jews have historically betrayed their host nations in times of war, occupation, and hardship. Byzantine history affords an example of a relentless conflict between the Jews and their host people during wartime. And this section is subtitled Constantinople, A Story of Repeated Betrayal. And I'm going to give you some of the quotes from historical sources of the repeated betrayal of the Christian people of Constantinople on behalf of the non-Christian invaders. Jewish writers Gedalia Alon and Michael Yavi Yonah show that Byzantine authorities prophetically feared that their Jews would aid Persian invaders. They were also correct in fearing that they would assist Muslim armies as well. Another, and you can get the quotations again and the documentation in my book and the exact sources where this comes from. And many of it comes from, by the way, Jewish histories. Jews were killed in great numbers after the uncovering of a Jewish plot to deliver the city to the Persians. Another one, Jews sided with the Persian invaders of the early 7th century in collusion with the Samaritans, massacred 100,000 Christians. Another, when the Christian Byzantines retook the city, Jews were forcibly converted to Christianity. Another, the Jews supported the Arabs when they conquered the area in 636-40. Another, in the 12th century, the Byzantine Jews supported the invading armies of Seljuk Turks. Another, in the 14th century, they supported the invasions of the Ottoman Turks, the final conquest of Constantinople occurring through a Jewish quarter with the active assistance of the Jews. And finally, in gratitude to their support, the Sultan imposed Jewish economic domination over his Christian subjects, and Jews immigrated into the area from throughout the diaspora. So here you see, ladies and gentlemen, is an example, and this is not in the book, but my commentary here, that where Jews in the same city, in the same empire, repeatedly, 1 century later, 2 centuries later, 3 centuries later, betrayed the people among whom they lived and worked every day, repeatedly. And many of these quotations that I'm giving you are from actual Jewish sources about it, talking about their own history. Now, a great deal of evidence exists that Jews supported the Saracen conquest of Spain and served as the harsh administrators of the Muslim occupation government. Jewish communities have aided the invader whenever they have seen an advantage in the overthrow of the existing order. Of course, Muslim societies have just as often been betrayed by Jews as have Christian ones. After the Second World War, Jews became the prominent administrators and secret police of the brutal regimes installed by the Soviets in Eastern Europe. In his 1981 book, Uprising, David Irving shows that Jews so dominated in the secret police that tortured and murdered hundreds of thousands in Soviet-controlled Hungary that anti-Semitism was one of the motivations of the anti-communist uprising, the famous uprising in 1956. Considering the Jewish involvement in the murderous specter of communism, it should be no puzzle why the Jews accuse Eastern Europeans as being, quote, the most anti-Semitic. In Russia itself, Jewish communists were the forces that dispossessed the Russians of their own government, that made up the leadership of the murderous KGB, and who murdered the Russian royal family, including all the children. America experienced one of the most treacherous acts of treason in the annals of history when Julius and Ethel Rosenberg and their Jewish co-conspirators stole America's atomic bomb secrets and gave them to the Soviets. During the Vietnam War, the Jewish dominated New Left and pro-Viet Cong demonstrations, while American boys died from Viet Cong bullets and bombs. The two most famous of the Vietnam-era seditionists were Abbie Hoffman and Jerry Rubin. Jewish spies for Israel, such as Jonathan Pollard, have stolen some of America's most closely guarded secrets. His stolen secrets were then bartered by Israel to the Soviets, which devastated our intelligence operations in Eastern Europe. Every Sunday school child is familiar with the biblical story of Joseph, his coat of many colors, unquote, and his betrayal by his brothers, enslavement, and subsequent rise to great power in Egypt. In college, a friend recommended that I read the account of Joseph and the Israelite sojourn in Egypt in light of my new understanding of historical Jewish behavior. I took out my Bible and turned to the last pages of Genesis and the first of Exodus. After reading and reflecting on what I read, I think I finally understood why God was so put out with the chosen people. Genesis introduces Joseph at age 17, tattling to his father, Jacob, about his brother's wrongdoing. Jacob is so taken by Joseph that he gives him a coat of many colors that evokes jealousy in the two brothers. The brothers are also disgusted by Joseph's self-aggrandizement in relating his dreams of his future superiority. In one dream, Joseph tells how he's in a field binding sheaves and how his sheaf stood up, whereas his brother's sheaves were gathered all around, bowed low. Soon afterward, he relates a dream in which the sun, the stars, and the moon bowed down before him. Even Jacob rebukes Joseph for his display of insufferable chutzpah. His brothers hate him so much that they decide to kill him and subsequently throw him down an abandoned well. However, when they see an Ishmaelite caravan bound for Egypt, they decide to sell their brother into slavery. Instead, Joseph is taken to Egypt, and he's eventually sold to Potiphar, captain of the Pharaoh's guard. Now, Joseph's glib tongue and financial acumen led to his rise as overseer of the entire household. Potiphar trusts him with every detail. One day, while Potiphar is away, his wife cries out that Joseph is trying to rape her. And when the other servants come running, they find Joseph's clothes left behind as he fled. Joseph claimed it was he who was the victim of an attempted rape. But an enraged Potiphar throws him into prison anyway. Again, using his cleverness and acumen, Joseph rises to become the top trustee of the prison and virtually runs the jail and has all the prisoners under his control. In the prison are several of Pharaoh's servants. From them, Joseph undoubtedly learns all the gossip and goings-on in the royal house. Two of Pharaoh's servants, a butler and a baker, have dreams that Joseph cleverly interprets. The butler is eventually reinstated, and after the Pharaoh has a disturbing dream, the butler tells Pharaoh about Joseph's abilities. Brought before the Pharaoh, Joseph interprets the famous dream of the seven fat beeves and the seven thin ones. Intelligently, understanding the cyclical nature of prosperity and famine, he tells the Pharaoh that there will be seven good years and seven bad ones. Joseph then suggests that the Pharaoh appoint a man, quote, discreet and wise, and set him over the land of Egypt. That's from Genesis 42:33. Pharaoh then makes Joseph the most powerful man in Egypt other than himself and has him gather up the crops of Egypt. For the next few years, Joseph collects vast amounts of grain from Egyptian farmers and ensconces himself as, quote, the Lord of Egypt and ruler of Egypt, acting in the name of Pharaoh. When drought and famine finally hit, Joseph hatches a scheme to increase his and the Pharaoh's wealth and power. as the starving Egyptians appeal to the Pharaoh to get back some of the grain that they have deposited over the years, the Pharaoh tells them to go talk to Joseph. He tells them that they must pay for the grain and, quote, gathers up all the money that was found in the land of Egypt. Genesis 47:14. A severe depression occurs when the currency fails. The following are a few of the powerful verses from Genesis. This is 47:15. And the money failed in the land of Egypt, in the land of Canaan. And all the Egyptians came to Joseph and said, give us bread, for why should we die in thy presence? For the money faileth. 16. And Joseph said, give your cattle, and I will give you food for your cattle if the money fail. 17. And they brought their cattle unto Joseph, and Joseph gave them bread in exchange for their horses, and for their flocks, and for the cattle of the herds, and for asses. And he fed them with bread for all their cattle for that year. 18. When that year was ended, they came to him a second year, and said unto him, we will not hide it from the Lord, how our money is spent. My Lord also hath our herds of cattle. There is not aught left in the sight of my Lord, but our bodies and our lands. Wherefore shall we die before thine eyes, both we and our land? Buy us and our land for bread, and our land will be slaves unto Pharaoh. And as for the people, he made slaves of them from one end of Egypt to the other. Unquote. So Joseph first takes away all the money of the free Egyptians, then all their domesticated animals, then their homes and lands, and finally puts them back in the land as Pharaoh's new slaves, with 20% of their crop going to the Pharaoh. The Pharaoh is ecstatic with this arrangement. His treasury is overflowing, and Joseph has taken away all the lands of the people and put them back on it, working essentially as sharecroppers. At the same time the Egyptians are going through this misery, Joseph sends for and brings all of his Jewish brethren to Egypt. Genesis makes it quite clear that Joseph gives the Israelites bags of gold and that they, quote, live off the fat of the land, unquote. 45:18. And take your father and your households and come unto me, and I will give you the good of the land of Egypt, and ye shall eat of the fat of the land. 47:6. The land of Egypt is before thee, and the best of the land make thy father and brethren to dwell. In the land of Goshen let them dwell. 47:13. And there was no bread in all the land of Egypt, for the famine was very sore. So that the land of Egypt and all the land of Canaan fainted by reason of the famine. But 47:27. And Israel dwelt in the land of Egypt, in the country of Goshen, and they had possessions therein, and grew and multiplied exceedingly. Now, one can imagine what the Egyptians thought about Joseph taking all their land and possessions and reducing them to slavery, while the foreign Israelites are given gold, free food, and the best of their land in all of Egypt. The Egyptians had built a grand civilization with magnificent artistic and cultural achievements, including advances in mathematics, engineering, architecture, astronomy, and agriculture. They had built the most enduring architectural creations of the world, the pyramids. How they must have chafed under the absolute power of this foreign tribe. According to Genesis and Exodus, the arrangement persisted for a long time, suggesting that the Israelites were the privileged administrators of Egypt during a long period of time. The Pharaoh could count on them having no loyalty to the native aristocrats or merchant class of Egypt, and they might have served the Pharaoh's purpose by directing the wrath of the people toward the Jews rather than toward the Pharaoh himself. At any rate, eventually, the numbers and political and economic power of Jews grew so excessive that even the royal family itself felt threatened. Now, this is a pattern that's often been repeated in Jewish history. Now, notice the following passages from Exodus. Exodus 1:7. And the children of Israel were fruitful, and increased abundantly, and multiplied, and waxed exceedingly mighty. And the land was filled with them. 1:8. Now there arose up a new king over Egypt, who knew not Joseph. And he said to his people, Behold, the people of the children of Israel are more and more powerful than we. And 1:10. Come on, let us deal wisely with them, lest they multiply, and it come to pass, when there falleth out any war, that they join also unto our enemies, and fight against us, and so get them up out of the land. Then are recorded dutifully the Egyptian pogroms against the Jews, and the Jewish celebration of Egyptian infanticide, and Jewish expulsion and deliverance, as represented in Passover. The Egyptian pharaoh was not the last who sought to expel Jews from his land. The following is a partial list of the expulsions of Jews from European kingdoms. And I will quote, here's some of the nations in my book. I'm not going to go through all of them. There's so many. In Mainz, 1012, France, 1182, Upper Bavaria, 1276, England, 1290, France, 1306, France, 1322, Saxony 1349, Hungary 1360, Belgium 1370, Slovakia 1380, France 1394. Notice Austria 1420. Many of these countries, they were expelled, and then a few years later, people forgot about what's going on, and they were let back in, and then problems arose again. They were expelled again. This goes on and on and on, this list, and every nation and principality of Europe has expelled the Jews, and many on repeated occasions. Zionist leader Chaim Weizmann wrote the following about frequent hostile reaction to the Jewish presence. Quote, whenever the quantity of Jews in any country reaches the saturation point, that country reacts against them. This reaction cannot be looked upon as anti-Semitism in the ordinary or vulgar sense of the word. It is a universal social and economic concomitant of Jewish immigration, and we cannot shake it off. According to the popular Jewish version of history, in every case, Gentiles were at fault in the conflict. After tolerantly allowing Jewish immigrants into their nation, Gentiles are accused of unreasoning hatred against Jews, who are depicted as blameless sources of economic and social benefit. Now, when I read of the hostility toward Jews in dozens of different locations and historical circumstances, it seemed analogous to a man charged and convicted of dozens of rapes in several states over the course of many years. The man claims that he's always innocent, and that the dozens of rape convictions are merely the results of an unreasoning hate that the victims had for him. One perceptive writer, Joseph Sobrin, said it well when he suggested that the term anti-Semite no longer means someone who dislikes Jews. It now means someone whom the Jews dislike. Next section is the Jewish view of anti-Semitism. As I continued my reading and research, I discovered what Jewish scholars believe is the historical origin of the Jew-Gentile conflict. If one delves back into the pages of Genesis, preceding the story of Joseph, one comes upon the striking story of Isaac and Rebekah and their two sons, Esau and Jacob. The Jewish faith claims the two sons represent the two separate nations of Jew and Gentile. This is from Genesis chapter 25, and I'll quote you verses from that chapter. And the Lord said to her, Two nations are in your womb, and two manner of people shall be separated from thy bowels, and the one people shall be stronger than the other people, and the elder shall serve the younger. And the first came out red all over like a hairy garment, and they called his name Esau. And after that came his brother Jacob, and he took hold on Esau's heel. And the boys grew, and Esau was a cunning hunter, a man of the field, and Jacob was a plain man dwelling in tents. And Isaac loved Esau, because he did eat of his venison. But Rebekah loved Jacob. And Esau came from the field, and he was faint, he was sick. And Esau said to Jacob, "Feed me, for I pray I am sick. Feed me with the same red pottage." Afterward he was called Edom, after the red pottage. And Jacob said, "I will feed you for the price of your birthright." And Esau said, "I am at the point of death. What good will my birthright do for me?" And Jacob said, "Swear to me your birthright, and I will feed you." Esau swore to him and sold his birthright, and Jacob fed him bread and pottage. And when Esau ate and drank, he got better. He went away. Close quote. Now, Esau's good and faithful conduct causes him to remain Isaac's favorite. Ailing and of poor eyesight, Isaac calls Esau and asks him to hunt down and bring him some venison, saying that after he did this, he would offer him the blessing of God. Rebekah, upon hearing this, schemes with Jacob to pretend that he is Esau and bring Isaac ram meat prepared to taste like venison. Jacob disguises himself to feel and even smell like Esau. Jacob then lies to his father and presents himself as the firstborn Esau. Ultimately, from this deceit and treachery, he receives his father's blessing. 19. Jacob said to his father, "I am Esau, your firstborn. I have done as you told me. Now sit up and eat of my game, that you may bless me." Then Isaac said to Jacob, "Come near, that I may feel you, my son, to know whether you are really my son Esau or not." So Jacob went near to Isaac, his father, who felt him and said, "The voice is Jacob's voice, but the hands are the hands of Esau." He said, "Are you really my son, Esau?" He answered, "I am." "Let peoples serve you, and nations bow down to you. Be lord over your brothers, and may your mother's sons bow down to you. Cursed be everyone who curses you, and blessed be everyone who blesses you." Returning from the hunt with the venison, Esau discovers that his brother had deceived his father and cheated him of his blessing. This is from verse 33. "I have eaten before you came and have blessed him, yes, and he will be blessed." And when Esau heard the words of his father, he cried with a great and exceeding bitter cry and said to his father, "Bless me also, O my beloved father." And he said, "My brother came and deceived and took away my blessing. He has robbed me two times. First he took away my birthright, and now he has taken away my blessing. Father, have you not reserved a blessing for me, Isaac? Behold, I have made him your lord, and all his brethren I have given to him for servants." And Esau lifted up his voice to him and wept. "And by your sword shall you live and serve thy brother. And it shall come to pass when you have dominion, you will break Jacob's yoke from your neck." Jacob and Esau found reconciliation 22 years later, but according to Jewish commentary, Esau's descendants became the Gentile Edomites, while Jacob's became the Jews. Jewish scholars later referred to the Romans as Edomites, and the term Esau became synonymous with Europeans and all Gentiles. The story of Jacob and Esau is an allegory of the Jew and Gentile with which the Jewish religion still identifies. Allusions to Esau are found in Raphael Patai's popular book, The Jewish Mind, and hundreds of other Jewish works. Sholem Aleichem, the famous Yiddish language author, wrote in his autobiography about a crude Russian ferryman, quote, "Esau, only a goy could do work like that, not a Jew. The Bible says of Esau, 'And thou shalt serve thy brother.' It is good that I am a descendant of Jacob and not of Esau." Popular Jewish intellectual writer Sidney Hook recounts how he questioned his Jewish teacher about the injustice of Jacob's actions against Esau. He quotes the rabbi as saying, "What kind of question is that? Esau was an animal." Jacob, who became renamed Israel, is considered the father of the Jewish people. Esau is seen as the archetype of the Gentile. Because Jews suggest that Jews are always blameless of the anti-Semitism inherent in Gentiles, Esau's hatred of Jacob is considered also the origin of anti-Semitism as well. Rabbi Leon Spitz, quoted in the American Hebrew, illustrates the depth of hatred of many Jews for Esau and his descendants. And I quote, "Let Esau whine and wail and protest to the civilized world, and let Jacob fight the good fight. The anti-Semite understands but one language, and he must be dealt with on his own level. The Purim Jews stood up for their lives. American Jews, too, must come to grips with our contemporary anti-Semites. We must fill our jails with anti-Semitic gangsters. We must fill our insane asylums with anti-Semitic lunatics. We must combat every alien Jew hater. We must harass and prosecute our Jew baiters to the extreme limits of the laws. We must humble and shame our anti-Semitic hoodlums to such an extent that none will wish or dare to become their fellow travelers." Unquote. When I understood that Jacob and Esau are an apt Jewish allegory for the eternal conflict between Jew and Gentile from a Jewish perspective, I realized that Gentiles might learn from it too. Is not the fact that Esau worked hard in the fields while Jacob stayed in tents symbolic of the history of Jew and Gentile? It corresponds perfectly with the Europeans' inherent love of nature, the outdoors, and land, with a Jew's love of urban life. Even reading the account written from the bias of Jacob's descendants, would not any fair-minded person find Esau's tears and rage justified? Is Jacob blameless and innocent, or was Esau the one cheated? Shylock, asking for a, quote, "pound of flesh" in Shakespeare's Merchant of Venice, represents no less avarice and cold-heartedness than does Jacob withholding food from a sick brother so that he could steal his birthright. In addition, consider Jacob's disguising of himself to defraud both his father and brother. Is that what the Jewish scholars see as justice? Is Esau's anger hate and, quote, "anti-Semitism"? Is it anti-Semitic to note that by its own account, Israel found its earliest roots in fraud, treachery, and deceit, and that it boasts about it? Perhaps Isaac was prophetic when he said that Esau would be a servant to his brother until he obtained dominion, complete control over the land in which he lived, and thus broke Jacob's yoke from around his neck. Even though the Philo-Semitic version of history is one long tale of Jewish woe at the hands of Gentiles, Jacob's descendants are certainly not the only ones who have suffered. Esau's children have lost untold billions to the descendants of Jacob in usury and fraud and organized crime. Millions of Gentiles have suffered torturous slavery, degradation, and death at the hands of Jewish masters in the slave trade and prostitution. Esau's tears have fallen for the murder of millions of Christians at the hands of Jewish Bolsheviks in Eastern and Central Europe. They have been shed for millions of combatants and civilians who died in the two great fratricidal world wars of the 20th century, encouraged in no small part by Jewish power. Is not Esau's justifiable rage found in the Palestinian people who lost their land, their freedom, and for so many, even the lives of their children? If the story of Jacob and Esau is what the Jewish rabbinates say it is, the story of the genesis of the Jew and Gentile, it is a story of Jewish deceit and treachery against those whom they consider Gentiles. Such treachery must end. If it continues, it's only a matter of time until Esau's rage rekindles once more. just as it has 1,000 times since the sons of Jacob first entered our lands. Thoughtful and intelligent Jews must recognize that just as certainly as Jews have grievances against Gentiles, Gentiles have real grievances against Jews. Those Jews must take sincere action to mitigate Jewish supremacism and destructive anti-Gentilism. They have the power of the media and wield great influence in government, certainly enough to break the cycle of Jewish supremacism and anti-Semitism. We do not ask Jews to sacrifice their identity and their heritage. In fact, we understand their natural urge for the survival of their culture and genetic heritage. But we demand that they recognize that same fundamental right for the people among whom they dwell. For instance, how hypocritical it is for Jews to promote in the Islamic world books that are deeply offensive to Muslims, such as Salman Rushdie's Satanic Verses, and for Jews to seek to ban Christmas carols from American public schools. Yet they seek support for the exclusively Jewish religion by American tax dollars. They campaign to open American borders to the Third World, while working to send American tax money to a nation that denies immigration to non-Jews, denying return even to those who were born there and whose families lived there for generations. If far-sighted Jews would refrain from such hypocrisies and abide by our standards of morality while living among us, if they would stop the manipulation and exploitation, then we may avoid the tragic anti-Semitic reaction that has erupted repeatedly in so many nations. From the lessons of Jewish history that I have learned from the works of the Jews themselves, it seems unlikely that their leadership will see the wisdom in my proposals. History teaches harsh and often bloody lessons, but few heed them. I also know that we cannot rest in the vain hope and trust of the magnanimity of our traditional enemies. No, we have the right to be masters in our own house. We have the natural right to have our Western nations reflect our own soul, our own spirit, our own aesthetics, our own art, our own values, our own desires, our own interests, and our own destiny. Every people, culture, and nation have that inherent right. As shown by history, one can never negotiate successfully from weakness, only from strength. It is our task to become strong. Knowing the truth will make us strong. We must understand that we are in an evolutionary life or death struggle, and we must understand that if we fail in this effort, all the beauty and greatness purchased by the blood and sacrifices of our ancestors will be lost, and along with them all hopes for the future of our people. As the Bible says so elegantly, only when Esau is dominion will Jacob's yoke be broken. I seek no yoke upon the Jewish people. I only seek our own dominion in our own lands, free of Jewish political, intellectual, and cultural domination and deformation. Jews may be able, theoretically, to trace their lineage to Jacob, but obviously, the European peoples of the earth were not born of Esau. Our progenitors, whether Nordic, Alpine, or Mediterranean, originally Arabic, have already built the Egyptian, Mesopotamian, Babylonian, Mycenaean, Sumerian, Hittite, and many other civilizations when Rebekah had her twin sons. Our ancestors designed the Great Pyramids and the complex astronomical observatory at Stonehenge, long before the Jews established the kingdoms of Solomon and David. I and my kinsmen seek no war against the Jews. We ask only to live and let live. But it must be made clear, we do intend to live. Only when Jewish supremacism abates will anti-Semitism disappear. Europeans, Asians, and Africans will not accept the deceit or the supremacy proclaimed by Jacob. We will not wear the yoke of subservience. Our dominion shall be won. We have earned the blessings of God and nature by our genius, by our hard work, by our creativity, and our faith. We will not shrink from the fight for our freedom, and we reject the label of anti-Semitism from those who are themselves the embodiment of ethnocentrism and tolerance and anti-gentilism. I am not an anti-Semite. I simply strive for the life and freedom of my people and all peoples and nations around the world. While having respect for those Jews who act honorably, I must oppose the Jewish supremacism that plagues so many nations. It is as simple as this: because I love my own people, I have no choice but to oppose those who would harm us or threaten our survival. Such is as natural and life-giving as the breath that we take each moment. As long as I live, I will breathe. As long as I live, I will defend the life and the freedom of my people. The next chapter begins our inquiry into Israel. Israel, which is Jewish supremacism in action. The next chapter is chapter 22, Israel, 1, a Jewish supremacist state.